Rule 7. Pursue what is meaningful, not what is expedient. Get while the getting's good. Life is suffering. That's clear. There is no more basic, irrefutable truth. It's basically what God tells Adam and Eve immediately before he kicks them out of paradise. Unto the woman he said, I will greatly multiply thy sorrow and thy conception. In sorrow thou shalt bring forth children, and thy desire shall be to thy husband, and he shall rule over thee. And unto Adam he said, Because thou hast hearkened unto the voice of thy wife, and hast eaten of the tree of which I commanded thee, saying, Thou shalt not eat of it, cursed is the ground for thy sake. In sorrow shalt thou eat of it all the days of thy life. Thorns also and thistles shall it bring forth to thee, and thou shalt eat the herb of the field. By the sweat of your brow you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you will return. Genesis 3:16-19, King James Version. What in the world should be done about that? The simplest, most obvious, and most direct answer? Pursue pleasure. Follow your impulses. Live for the moment. Do what's expedient. Lie, cheat, steal, deceive, manipulate. But don't get caught. In an ultimately meaningless universe, what possible difference could it make? And this is by no means a new idea. The fact of life's tragedy and the suffering that is part of it has been used to justify the pursuit of immediate selfish gratification for a very long time. Short and sorrowful is our life, and there is no remedy when a man comes to his end, and no one has been known to return from Hades. Because we were born by mere chance, and hereafter we shall be as though we had never been, because the breath in our nostrils is smoke, and reason is a spark kindled by the beating of our hearts. When it is extinguished, the body will turn to ashes, and the spirit will dissolve like empty air. Our name will be forgotten in time, and no one will remember our works. Our life will pass away like the traces of a cloud, and be scattered like mist that is chased by the rays of the sun, and overcome by its heat. For our allotted time is the passing of a shadow, and there is no return from our death, because it is sealed up and no one turns back. Come, therefore, let us enjoy the good things that exist, and make use of the creation to the full, as in youth. Let us take our fill of costly wine and perfumes, and let no flower of spring pass by us. Let us crown ourselves with rosebuds before they wither. Let none of us fail to share in our revelry. Everywhere let us leave signs of enjoyment, because this is our portion, and this our lot. Let us oppress the righteous poor man. Let us not spare the widow, nor regard the gray hairs of the aged. But let our might be our law of right, for what is weak proves itself to be useless. Wisdom 2:1-11, Revised Standard Version. Pleasure of expediency may be fleeting, but it's pleasure nonetheless, and that's something to stack up against the terror and pain of existence. Every man for himself, and the devil take the hindmost, as the old proverb has it. Why not simply take everything you can get whenever the opportunity arises? Why not determine to live in that manner? Or is there an alternative, more powerful and more compelling? Our ancestors worked out very sophisticated answers to such questions, but we still don't understand them very well. This is because they are in large part still implicit, manifest primarily in ritual and myth, and as of yet incompletely articulated. We act them out and represent them in stories, but we're not yet wise enough to formulate them explicitly. We're still chimps in a troop or wolves in a pack. We know how to behave. We know who's who and why. We've learned that through experience. Our knowledge has been shaped by our interaction with others. We've established predictable routines and patterns of behavior, but we don't really understand them or know where they originated. They've evolved over great expanses of time. No one was formulating them explicitly, at least not in the dimmest reaches of the past, even though we've been telling each other how to act forever, One day, however, not so long ago, we woke up. We were already doing, but we started noticing what we were doing. We started using our bodies as devices to represent their own actions. We started imitating and dramatizing. We invented ritual. We started acting out our own experiences. Then we started to tell stories. We coded our observations of our own drama in these stories. In this manner, the information that was first only embedded in our behavior became represented in our stories. But we didn't, and still don't, understand what it all means. The biblical narrative of paradise and the fall is one such story, fabricated by our collective imagination, working over the centuries. It provides a profound account of the nature of being and points the way to a mode of conceptualization and action well matched to that nature. In the Garden of Eden, prior to the dawn of self-consciousness, so goes the story, human beings were sinless. Our primordial parents, Adam and Eve, walked with God. Then, tempted by the snake, the first couple ate from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, discovered death and vulnerability, and turned away from God. Mankind was exiled from paradise and began its effortful mortal existence. The idea of sacrifice enters soon afterwards, beginning with the account of Cain and Abel, and developing through the Abrahamic adventures and the Exodus. After much contemplation, struggling humanity learns that God's favor could be gained and his wrath averted through proper sacrifice, and also that bloody murder might be motivated among those unwilling or unable to succeed in this manner. The delay of gratification. When engaging in sacrifice, our forefathers began to act out what would be considered a proposition if it were stated in words, that something better might be attained in the future by giving up something of value in the present. Recall, if you will, that the necessity for work is one of the curses placed by God upon Adam and his descendants in consequence of original sin. Adam's waking to the fundamental constraints of his being, his vulnerability, his eventual death, is equivalent to his discovery of the future. The future. That's where you go to die. Hopefully not too soon. Your demise might be staved off through work, through the sacrifice of the now, to gain benefit later. It is for this reason, among others, no doubt, that the concept of sacrifice is introduced in the biblical chapter immediately following the drama of the fall. There's little difference between sacrifice and work. They are also both uniquely human. Sometimes animals act as if they are working, but they are really only following the dictates of their nature. Beavers build dams. They do so because they are beavers. Beavers build dams. They don't think, yeah, but I'd rather be on a beach in Mexico with my girlfriend while they're doing it. Prosaically, such sacrifice, work, is delay of gratification. But that's a very mundane phrase to describe something of such profound significance. The discovery that gratification could be delayed was simultaneously the discovery of time and, with it, causality. At least the causal force of voluntary human action. Long ago, in the dim mists of time, we began to realize that reality was structured as if it could be bargained with. We learned that behaving properly now, in the present, regulating our impulses, considering the plight of others, could bring rewards in the future, in a time and place that did not yet exist. We began to inhibit, control, and organize our immediate impulses so that we could stop interfering with other people and our future selves. Doing so was indistinguishable from organizing society. The discovery of the causal relationship between our efforts today and the quality of tomorrow motivated the social contract, the organization that enables today's work to be stored reliably, mostly in the form of promises from others. Understanding is often acted out before it can be articulated, just as a child acts out what it means to be mother or father before being able to give a spoken account of what those roles mean. The act of making a ritual sacrifice to God was an early and sophisticated enactment of the idea of the usefulness of delay. There's a long conceptual journey between merely feasting hungrily and learning to set aside some extra meat smoked by the fire for the end of the day or for someone who isn't present. It takes a long time to learn to keep anything later for yourself or to share it with someone else. And those are very much the same thing as, in the former case, you are sharing with your future self. It is much easier and far more likely to selfishly and immediately wolf down everything in sight. There are similar long journeys between every leap in sophistication with regard to delay and its conceptualization. Short-term sharing, storing away for the future, representation of that storage in the form of records, and later in the form of currency, and ultimately the saving of money in a bank or other social institution. Some conceptualizations had to serve as intermediaries, or the full range of our practices and ideas surrounding sacrifice and work and their representation could have never emerged. Our ancestors acted out a drama, a fiction. They personified the force that governs fate as a spirit that can be bargained with, traded with, as if it were another human being. And the amazing thing is that it worked. This was in part because the future is largely composed of other human beings, often precisely those who have watched and evaluated and appraised the tiniest details of your past behavior. It's not very far from that to God, sitting above on high, tracking your every move and writing it down for further reference in a big book. Here's a productive, symbolic idea. The future is a judgmental father. That's a good start. But two additional archetypal, foundational questions arose because of the discovery of sacrifice, of work. Both have to do with the ultimate extension of the logic of work, which is sacrifice now to gain later. First question. What must be sacrificed? Small sacrifices may be sufficient to solve small, singular problems. But it is possible that larger, more comprehensive sacrifices might solve an array of large and complex problems all at the same time. That's harder, but it might be better. Adapting to the necessary discipline of medical school will, for example, fatally interfere with the licentious lifestyle of a hardcore undergraduate party animal. Giving that up is a sacrifice. But a physician can, to paraphrase George W., really put food on his family. That's a lot of trouble dispensed with over a very long period of time. So, sacrifices are necessary to improve the future, and larger sacrifices can be better. Second question. Set of related questions, really. We've already established the basic principle. Sacrifice will improve the future. But a principle, once established, has to be fleshed out. Its full extension or significance has to be understood. What is implied by the idea that sacrifice will improve the future, in the most extreme and final of cases? Where does that basic principle find its limits? We must ask, to begin, what would be the largest, most effective, most pleasing of all possible sacrifices? And then, how good might the best possible future be if the most effective sacrifice could be made? The biblical story of Cain and Abel, Adam and Eve's sons, immediately follows the story of the expulsion from paradise, as mentioned previously. Cain and Abel are really the first humans, since their parents were made directly by God and not born in the standard manner. Cain and Abel live in history, not in Eden. They must work. They must make sacrifices to please God, and they do so with altar and proper ritual. But things get complicated. Abel's offerings please God, but Cain's do not. Abel is rewarded many times over, but Cain is not. It's not precisely clear why, although the text strongly hints that Cain's heart is just not in it. Maybe the quality of what Cain put forward was low. Maybe his spirit was begrudging. Or maybe God was vexed for some secret reasons of his own. And all of this is realistic, including the text's vagueness of explanation. Not all sacrifices are of equal quality. Furthermore, it often appears that sacrifices of apparently high quality are not rewarded with a better future. And it's not clear why. Why isn't God happy? What would have to change to make him so? Those are difficult questions, and everyone asks them all the time, even if they don't notice. Asking such questions is indistinguishable from thinking. The realization that pleasure could be usefully forestalled dawned on us with great difficulty. It runs absolutely contrary to our ancient fundamental animal instincts, which demand immediate satisfaction, particularly under conditions of deprivation, which are both inevitable and commonplace. And, to complicate the matter, such delay only becomes useful when civilization has stabilized itself enough to guarantee the existence of the delayed reward in the future. If everything you save will be destroyed, or worse, stolen, there is no point in saving. It is for this reason that a wolf will down 20 pounds of raw meat in a single meal. He isn't thinking, "Man, I hate it when I binge. I should save some of this for next week." So how was it that those two impossible and necessarily simultaneous accomplishments, delay and the stabilization of society into the future, could possibly have manifested themselves? Here is a developmental progression from animal to human. It's wrong, no doubt, in the details, but it's sufficiently correct for our purposes in theme. First, there is excess food. Large carcasses, mammoths or other massive herbivores, might provide that. We ate a lot of mammoths, maybe all of them. After a kill with a large animal, there's some left for later. That's accidental at first, but eventually the utility of "for later" starts to be appreciated. Some provisional notion of sacrifice develops at the same time. If I leave some, even if I want it now, I won't have to be hungry later. That provisional notion develops to the next level. If I leave some for later, I won't have to go hungry, and neither will those I care for. And then to the next, I can't possibly eat all of this mammoth, but I can't store the rest for too long either. Maybe I should feed some to other people. Maybe they'll remember and feed me some of their mammoth when they have some, and I have none. Then I'll get some mammoth now, and some mammoth later. That's a good deal. And maybe those I'm sharing with will come to trust me more generally. Maybe then we could trade forever. In such a manner, mammoth becomes future mammoth, and future mammoth becomes personal reputation. That's the emergence of the social contract. To share does not mean to give away something you value and get nothing back. That is, instead, only what every child who refuses to share fears it means. To share means, properly, to initiate the process of trade. A child who can't share, who can't trade, can't have any friends, because having friends is a form of trade. Benjamin Franklin once suggested that a newcomer to a neighborhood ask a new neighbor to do him or her a favor, citing an old maxim. He that has once done you a kindness will be more ready to do you another than he whom you yourself have obliged. In Franklin's opinion, asking someone for something, not too extreme, obviously, was the most useful and immediate invitation to social interaction. Such asking on the part of the newcomer provided the neighbor with an opportunity to show him or herself as a good person at first encounter. It also meant that the latter could now ask the former for a favor in return because of the debt incurred, increasing their mutual familiarity and trust. In that manner, both parties could overcome their natural hesitancy and mutual fear of the stranger. It is better to have something than nothing. It's better yet to share generously the something you have. It's even better than that, however, to become widely known for generous sharing. That's something that lasts. That's something that's reliable. And, at this point of abstraction, we can observe how the groundwork for the conceptions reliable, honest, and generous has been laid. The basis for an articulated morality has been put in place. The productive, truthful sharer is the prototype for the good citizen and the good man. We can see in this manner how, from the simple notion that leftovers are a good idea, the highest moral principles might emerge. It's as if something like the following happened as humanity developed. First were the endless tens or hundreds of thousands of years prior to the emergence of written history and drama. During this time, the twin practices of delay and exchange begin to emerge, slowly and painfully. Then they become represented in metaphorical abstraction as rituals and tales of sacrifice, told in a manner such as this. It's as if there's a powerful figure in the sky who sees all and is judging you. Giving up something you value seems to make him happy, and you want to make him happy, because all hell breaks loose if you don't. So, practice sacrificing and sharing until you become expert at it, and things will go well for you. No one said any of this, at least not so plainly and directly, but it was implicit in the practice and then in the stories. Action came first, as it had to, as the animals we once were could act, but could not think. Implicit unrecognized value came first, as the actions that preceded thought embodied value, but did not make that value explicit. People watched the successful succeed and the unsuccessful fail for thousands and thousands of years. We thought it over and drew a conclusion. The successful among us delay gratification. The successful among us bargain with the future. A great idea begins to emerge, taking ever more clearly articulated form in ever more clearly articulated stories. What's the difference between the successful and the unsuccessful? The successful sacrifice. Things get better as the successful practice their sacrifices. The questions become increasingly precise and simultaneously broader. What is the greatest possible sacrifice for the greatest possible good? And the answers become increasingly deeper and profound. The God of Western tradition, like so many gods, requires sacrifice. We have already examined why. But sometimes he goes even further. He demands not only sacrifice, but the sacrifice of precisely what is loved best. This is most starkly portrayed, and most confusingly evident, in the story of Abraham and Isaac. Abraham, beloved of God, long wanted a son. And God promised him exactly that, after many delays, and under the apparently impossible conditions of old age and a long barren wife. But not so long afterward, when the miraculously born Isaac is still a child, God turns around and, in unreasonable and apparently barbaric fashion, demands that his faithful servant offer his son as a sacrifice. The story ends happily. God sends an angel to stay Abraham's obedient hand and accepts a ram in Isaac's stead. That's a good thing, but it doesn't really address the issue at hand. Why is God's going further necessary? Why does life, impose such demands? We'll start our analysis with a truism, stark, self-evident, and understated. Sometimes things do not go well. That seems to have much to do with the terrible nature of the world, with its plagues and famines and tyrannies and betrayals. But here's the rub. Sometimes, when things are not going well, it's not the world that's the cause. The cause is, instead, that which is currently most valued, subjectively and personally. Why? because the world is revealed to an indeterminate degree through the template of your values. Much more on this in Rule 10. If the world you are seeing is not the world you want, therefore, it's time to examine your values. It's time to rid yourself of your current presuppositions. It's time to let go. It might even be time to sacrifice what you love best so that you can become who you might become instead of staying who you are. There's an old and possibly apocryphal story about how to catch a monkey that illustrates this set of ideas very well. First, you must find a large, narrow-necked jar, just barely wide enough in diameter at the top, for a monkey to put its hand inside. Then you must fill the jar partway with rocks, so it is too heavy for a monkey to carry. Then you must scatter some treats, attractive to monkeys, near the jar, to attract one. Put some more inside the jar. A monkey will come along, reach into the narrow opening, and grab while the grabbing's good. But now he won't be able to extract his fist, now full of treats, from the too narrow opening of the jar. Not without unclenching his hand. Not without relinquishing what he already has. And that's just what he won't do. The monkey catcher can just walk over to the jar and pick up the monkey. The animal will not sacrifice the part to preserve the whole. Something valuable given up ensures future prosperity. Something valuable sacrificed pleases the Lord. What is most valuable and best sacrificed? Or what is at least emblematic of that? A choice cut of meat, the best animal in a flock, a most valued possession. What's above even that? Something intensely personal and painful to give up. That's symbolized, perhaps, in God's insistence on circumcision as part of Abraham's sacrificial routine, where the part is offered, symbolically, to redeem the whole. What's beyond that? What pertains more closely to the whole person rather than the part? What constitutes the ultimate sacrifice for the gain of the ultimate prize? It's a close race between child and self. The sacrifice of the mother offering her child to the world is exemplified profoundly by Michelangelo's great sculpture, the Pietà. Michelangelo crafted Mary contemplating her son, crucified and ruined. It's her fault. It was through her that he entered the world and its great drama of being. Is it right to bring a baby into this terrible world? Every woman asks herself that question. Some say no, and they have their reasons. Mary answers yes, voluntarily, knowing full well what's to come, as do all mothers, if they allow themselves to see. It's an act of supreme courage when undertaken voluntarily. In turn, Mary's son, Christ, offers himself to God and the world, to betrayal, torture, and death, to the very point of despair on the cross, where he cries out those terrible words, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Matthew 27:46. That is the archetypal story of the man who gives his all for the sake of the better, who offers up his life for the advancement of being, who allows God's will to become manifest fully within the confines of a single mortal life. That is the model for the honorable man. In Christ's case, however, as he sacrifices himself, God, his Father, is simultaneously sacrificing his Son. It is for this reason that the Christian sacrificial drama of Son and Self is archetypal. It's a story at the limit where nothing more extreme, nothing greater, can be imagined. That's the very definition of archetypal. That's the core of what constitutes religious. Pain and suffering define the world. Of that, there can be no doubt. Sacrifice can hold pain and suffering in abeyance to a greater or lesser degree, and greater sacrifices can do that more effectively than lesser. Of that, there can be no doubt. Everyone holds this knowledge in their soul. Thus, the person who wishes to alleviate suffering, who wishes to rectify the flaws in being, who wants to bring about the best of all possible futures, who wants to create heaven on earth, will make the greatest of sacrifices of self and child, of everything that is loved, to live a life aimed at the good. He will forego expediency. He will pursue the path of ultimate meaning, and he will in that manner bring salvation to the ever-desperate world. But is such a thing even possible? Is this simply not asking too much of the individual? It's all well and good for Christ, it might be objected, but he was the veritable Son of God. But we do have other examples, some much less mythologized and archetypal. Consider, for example, the case of Socrates, the ancient Greek philosopher. After a lifetime of seeking the truth and educating his countrymen, Socrates faced a trial for crimes against the city-state of Athens, his hometown. His accusers provided him with plenty of opportunity to simply leave and avoid the trouble. But the great sage had already considered and rejected this course of action. His companion Hermogenes observed him at this time, discussing any and every subject other than his trial, and asked him why he appeared so unconcerned. Socrates first answered that he had been preparing his whole life to defend himself, but then said something more mysterious and significant. When he attempted specifically to consider strategies that would produce acquittal by fair means or foul, or even when merely considering his potential actions at the trial, he found himself interrupted by his divine sign, his internal spirit, voice, or demon. Socrates discussed this voice at the trial itself. He said that one of the factors distinguishing him from other men was his absolute willingness to listen to its warnings, to stop speaking and cease acting when it objected. The gods themselves had deemed him wise above other men, not least for this reason, according to the Delphic oracle herself, held to be a reliable judge of such things. Because his ever-reliable internal voice objected to fleeing, or even to defending himself, Socrates radically altered his view of the significance of his trial. He began to consider that it might be a blessing rather than a curse. He told Hermogenes of his realization that the spirit to whom he had always listened might be offering him a way out of life in a manner easiest but also the least irksome to one's friends, with sound body and a spirit capable of showing kindliness, and absent the throes of illness and vexations of extreme old age. Socrates' decision to accept his fate allowed him to put away mortal terror in the face of death itself, prior to and during the trial, after the sentence was handed down, and even later, during his execution. He saw that his life had been so rich and full that he could let it go, gracefully. He was given the opportunity to put his affairs in order. He saw that he could escape the terrible, slow degeneration of the advancing years. He came to understand all that was happening to him as a gift from the gods. He was not therefore required to defend himself against his accusers, at least not with the aim of pronouncing his innocence and escaping his fate. Instead, he turned the tables, addressing his judges in a manner that makes the reader understand precisely why the town council wanted this man dead. Then he took his poison like a man. Socrates rejected expediency and the necessity for manipulation that accompanied it. He chose instead, under the direst of conditions, to maintain his pursuit of the meaningful and the true. 2,500 years later, we remember his decision and take comfort from it. What can we learn from this? If you cease to utter falsehoods and live according to the dictates of your conscience, you can maintain your nobility, even when facing the ultimate threat, if you abide truthfully and courageously by the highest of ideals. You will be provided with more security and strength than will be offered by any short-sighted concentration on your own safety. If you live properly, fully, you can discover meaning so profound that it protects you even from the fear of death. Could all that possibly be true? death, toil, and evil. The tragedy of self-conscious being produces suffering, inevitable suffering. That suffering, in turn, motivates the desire for selfish, immediate gratification, for expediency. But sacrifice and work serves far more effectively than short-term impulsive pleasure at keeping suffering at bay. However, tragedy itself, conceived of as the arbitrary harshness of society and nature set against the vulnerability of the individual, is not the only, and perhaps not even the primary, source of suffering. There's also the problem of evil to consider. The world is set hard against us, of a certainty, but man's inhumanity to man is something even worse. Thus, the problem of sacrifice is compounded in its complexity. It is not only privation and mortal limitation that must be addressed by work, by the willingness to offer and to give up. It is the problem of evil as well. Consider once again the story of Adam and Eve. Life becomes very hard for their children, that's us, after the fall and awakening of our archetypal parents. First is the terrible fate awaiting us in the post-paradisal world, in the world of history. Not the least of this is what Goethe called our creative endless toil. Humans work, as we have seen. We work because we have awakened to the truth of our own vulnerability, our subjugation to disease and death, and wish to protect ourselves for as long as possible. Once we can see the future, we must prepare for it, or live in denial and terror. We therefore sacrifice the pleasures of today for the sake of a better tomorrow. But the realization of mortality and the necessity of work is not the only revelation to Adam and Eve when they eat the forbidden fruit, wake up, and open their eyes. They were also granted, or cursed by, the knowledge of good and evil. It took me decades to understand what that means, to understand even part of what that means. It's this: once you become consciously aware that you, yourself, are vulnerable, you understand the nature of human vulnerability in general. You understand what it's like to be fearful and angry and resentful and bitter. You understand what pain means. And once you truly understand such feelings in yourself and how they're produced, you understand how to produce them in others. It is in this manner that the self-conscious beings that we are become voluntarily and exquisitely capable of tormenting others. And ourselves, of course, but it's the others we are concerned about right now. We see the consequences of this new knowledge manifest themselves when we meet Cain and Abel, the sons of Adam and Eve. By the time of their appearance, mankind has learned to make sacrifices to God. On altars of stone designed for that purpose, a communal ritual is performed. The immolation of something valuable, a choice animal or portion thereof, and its transformation through fire to the smoke, to the spirit, that rises to heaven above. In this manner, the idea of delay is dramatized so that the future might improve. Abel's sacrifices are accepted by God, and he flourishes. Cain's, however, are rejected. He becomes jealous and bitter, and it's no wonder. If someone fails and is rejected because he refused to make any sacrifices at all, well, that's at least understandable. He may still feel resentful and vengeful, but knows in his heart that he is personally to blame. That knowledge generally places a limit on his outrage. It's much worse, however, if he had actually forgone the pleasures of the moment, if he had strived and toiled, and things still didn't work out, if he was rejected despite his efforts. Then he's lost the present and the future. Then his work, his sacrifice, has been pointless. Under such conditions, the world darkens and the soul rebels. Cain is outraged by his rejection. He confronts God, accuses him, and curses his creation. That proves to be a very poor decision. God responds in no uncertain terms that the fault is all with Cain. And worse, that Cain has knowingly and creatively dallied with sin and reaped the consequences. This is not at all what Cain wanted to hear. It's by no means an apology on God's part. Instead, it's insult added to injury. Cain, embittered to the core by God's response, plots revenge. He defies the Creator audaciously. It's daring. Cain knows how to hurt. He's self-conscious, after all, and has become even more so in his suffering and shame. So he murders Abel in cold blood. He kills his brother, his own ideal, as Abel is everything Cain wishes to be. He commits this most terrible of crimes to spite himself, all of mankind, and God himself all at once. He does it to wreak havoc and gain his vengeance. He does it to register his fundamental opposition to existence, to protest the intolerable vagaries of being itself. And Cain's children, the offspring, as it were, of both his body and his decision, are worse. In his existential fury, Cain kills once. Lamech, his descendant, goes much further. "I have slain a man to my wounding," says Lamech, "and a young man to my hurt. If Cain shall be avenged sevenfold, truly Lamech 70 and 7-fold. Genesis 4:23-24. Tubal-Cain, an instructor of every artificer in brass and iron, Genesis 4:22, is by tradition 7 generations from Cain, and the first creator of weapons of war. And next in the Genesis stories comes the flood. The juxtaposition is by no means accidental. Evil enters the world with self-consciousness. The toil with which God curses Adam, that's bad enough. The trouble in childbirth with which Eve is burdened, and her consequent dependence on her husband, are no trivial matters either. They are indicative of the implicit and oft agonizing tragedies of insufficiency, privation, brute necessity, and subjugation to illness and death that simultaneously define and plague existence. Their mere factual reality is sometimes sufficient to turn even a courageous person against life. It has been my experience, however, that human beings are strong enough to tolerate the implicit tragedies of being without faltering, without breaking, or worse, breaking bad. I've seen evidence of this repeatedly in my private life, in my work as a professor, and in my role as a clinical practitioner. Earthquakes, floods, poverty, cancer, we're tough enough to take on all of that. But human evil adds a whole new dimension of misery to the world. It is for this reason that the rise of self-consciousness and its attendant realization of mortality and knowledge of good and evil is presented in the early chapters of Genesis and in the vast tradition that surrounds them as a cataclysm of cosmic magnitude. Conscious human malevolence can break the spirit even tragedy could not shake. I remember discovering, with her, that one of my clients had been shocked into years of serious post-traumatic stress disorder, daily physical shaking and terror, and chronic nightly insomnia, by the mere expression on her enraged, drunken boyfriend's face. His fallen countenance, Genesis 4:5, indicated his clear and conscious desire to do her harm. She was more naive than she should have been, and that predisposed her to the trauma. But that's not the point. The voluntary evil we do one another can be profoundly and permanently damaging, even to the strong. And what is it precisely that motivates such evil? It doesn't make itself manifest merely in consequence of the hard lot of life. It doesn't even emerge simply because of failure itself, or because of the disappointment and bitterness that failure often and understandably engenders. But the hard lot of life, magnified by the consequence of continually rejected sacrifices, however poorly conceptualized, however half-heartedly executed, that will bend and twist people into the truly monstrous forms who then begin consciously to work evil, who then begin to generate for themselves and others little besides pain and suffering, and who do it for the sake of that pain and suffering. In that manner, a truly vicious circle takes hold. Begrudging sacrifice, half-heartedly undertaken. Rejection of that sacrifice by God or by reality, take your pick. Angry resentment generated by that rejection. Descent into bitterness and the desire for revenge. Sacrifice undertaken even more begrudgingly or refused altogether. And it's hell itself that serves as the destination place of that downward spiral. Life is indeed nasty, brutish, and short, as the English philosopher Thomas Hobbes so memorably remarked. But man's capacity for evil makes it worse. This means that the central problem of life, the dealing with its brute facts, is not merely what and how to sacrifice to diminish suffering, but what and how to sacrifice to diminish suffering and evil. The conscious and voluntary and vengeful source of the worst suffering. The story of Cain and Abel is one manifestation of the archetypal tale of the hostile brothers, hero and adversary, the two elements of the individual human psyche, one aimed up at the good and the other down at hell itself. Abel is a hero, true, but a hero who is ultimately defeated by Cain. Abel could please God, a non-trivial and unlikely accomplishment, but he could not overcome human evil. For this reason, Abel is archetypally incomplete. Perhaps he was naive, although a vengeful brother can be inconceivably treacherous and subtle, like the snake in Genesis 3:1. But excuses, even reasons, even understandable reasons, don't matter, not in the final analysis. The problem of evil remained unsolved even by the divinely acceptable sacrifices of Abel. It took thousands of additional years for humanity to come up with anything else resembling a solution. The same issue emerges again in its culminating form, in the story of Christ and his temptation by Satan. But this time it's expressed more comprehensively, and the hero wins. Evil confronted. Jesus was led into the wilderness, according to the story, to be tempted by the devil, Matthew 4:1, prior to his crucifixion. This is the story of Cain, restated abstractly. Cain is neither content nor happy, as we have seen. He's working hard, or so he thinks, but God is not pleased. Meanwhile, Abel is, by all appearances, dancing his way through life. His crops flourish. Women love him. Worst of all, he's a genuinely good man. Everyone knows it. He deserves his good fortune. All the more reason to envy and hate him. Things do not progress well for Cain, by contrast, and he broods on his misfortune like a vulture on an egg. He strives in his misery to give birth to something hellish, and in doing so enters the desert wilderness of his own mind. He obsesses over his ill fortune. His betrayal by God. He nourishes his resentment. He indulges in ever more elaborate fantasies of revenge. And as he does so, his arrogance grows to Luciferian proportions. I'm ill-used and oppressed, he thinks. This is a stupid, bloody planet. As far as I'm concerned, it can go to hell. And with that, Cain encounters Satan in the wilderness for all intents and purposes and falls prey to his temptations. And he does what he can to make things as bad as possible, motivated by, in John Milton's imperishable words, so deep a malice to confound the race of mankind in one root, and earth with hell to mingle and involve, done all to spite the great Creator. Cain turns to evil to obtain what good denied him. And he does it voluntarily, self-consciously, and with malice aforethought. Christ takes a different path. His sojourn in the desert is the dark night of the soul, a deeply human and universal human experience. It's the journey to that place each of us goes when things fall apart, friends and family are distant, hopelessness and despair reign and black nihilism beckons. And let us suggest, in testament to the exactitude of the story, 40 days and nights starving alone in the wilderness might take you exactly to that place. It is in such a manner that the objective and subjective worlds come crashing synchronistically together. 40 days is a deeply symbolic period of time, echoing the 40 years the Israelites spent wandering in the desert after escaping the tyranny of Pharaoh and Egypt. 40 days is a long time in the underworld of dark assumptions, confusion, and fear, long enough to journey to the very center, which is hell itself. A journey there to see the sights can be undertaken by anyone. Anyone, that is, who is willing to take the evil of self and man with sufficient seriousness, a bit of familiarity with history, can help. A sojourn through the totalitarian horrors of the 20th century, with its concentration camps, forced labor, and murderous ideological pathologies, is as good a place as any to start. That, and some consideration of the fact that the worst of the concentration camp guards were human, all too human, too. That's all part of making the desert story real again, part of updating it for the modern mind. After Auschwitz, said Theodor Adorno, student of authoritarianism, there should be no poetry. He was wrong, but the poetry should be about Auschwitz. In the grim wake of the last 10 decades of the previous millennium, the terrible destructiveness of man has become a problem whose seriousness self-evidently dwarfs even the problem of unredeemed suffering. And neither one of those problems is going to be solved in the absence of a solution to the other. This is where the idea of Christ's taking on the sins of mankind as if they were his own becomes key, opening the door to deep understanding of the desert encounter with the devil himself. Homo sum, humani nihil a me alienem puto, said the Roman playwright Terence. Nothing human is alien to me. No tree can grow to heaven, adds the ever-terrifying Carl Gustav Jung, psychoanalyst extraordinaire, unless its roots reach down to hell. Such a statement should give everyone who encounters it pause. There was no possibility for movement upward in that great psychiatrist's deeply considered opinion without a corresponding move down. It is for this reason that enlightenment is so rare. Who is willing to do that? Do you really want to meet who's in charge at the very bottom of the most wicked thoughts? What did Eric Harris, mass murderer of the Columbine High School, write so incomprehensibly the very day prior to massacring his classmates? It's interesting when I'm in my human form, knowing I'm going to die. Everything has a touch of triviality to it. Who would dare explain such a missive, or worse, explain it away? In the desert, Christ encounters Satan. See Luke 4, 1-13 and Matthew 4, 1-11. This story has a clear psychological meaning, a metaphorical meaning, in addition to whatever else material and metaphysical alike it might signify. It means that Christ is forever he who determines to take personal responsibility for the full depth of human depravity. It means that Christ is eternally he who is willing to confront and deeply consider and risk the temptations posed by the most malevolent elements of human nature. It means that Christ is always he who is willing to confront evil consciously, fully, and voluntarily, in the form that dwelt simultaneously within him and in the world. This is nothing merely abstract, although it is abstract, nothing to be brushed over. It's no merely intellectual matter. Soldiers who develop post-traumatic stress disorder frequently develop it not because of something they saw, but because of something they did. There are many demons, so to speak, on the battlefield. Involvement in warfare is something that can open a gateway to hell. Now and then something climbs through, and possesses some naive farm boy from Iowa, and he turns monstrous. He does something terrible. He rapes and kills the women and massacres the infants of My Lai, and he watches himself do it. And some dark part of him enjoys it, and that is the part that is most unforgettable. And later, he will not know how to reconcile himself with the reality about himself and the world that was then revealed. And no wonder. In the great and fundamental myths of ancient Egypt, the god Horus, often regarded as a precursor to Christ, historically and conceptually speaking, experienced the same thing when he confronted his evil uncle Set, usurper of the throne of Osiris, Horus's father. Horus, the all-seeing Egyptian falcon god, the Egyptian eye of supreme eternal attention itself, has the courage to contend with Set's true nature, meeting him in direct combat. In the struggle with his dread uncle, however, his consciousness is damaged. He loses an eye. This is despite his godly stature and his unparalleled capacity for vision. What would a mere man lose who attempted the same thing? But perhaps he might gain in internal vision and understanding something proportional to what he loses in perception of the outside world. Satan embodies the refusal of sacrifice. He is arrogance incarnate, spite, deceit, and cruel conscious malevolence. He is pure hatred of man, God, and being. He will not humble himself, even when he knows full well that he should. Furthermore, he knows exactly what he is doing, obsessed with the desire for destruction, and does it deliberately, thoughtfully, and completely. It has to be him, therefore, the very archetype of evil, who confronts and tempts Christ, the archetype of good. It must be him who offers to the Savior of mankind, under the most trying of conditions, what all men most ardently desire. Satan first tempts the starving Christ to quell his hunger by transforming the desert rocks into bread. Then he suggests that he throw himself off a cliff, calling on God and the angels to break his fall. Christ responds to the first temptation by saying, "One does not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God." What does this answer mean? It means that even under conditions of extreme privation, there are more important things than food. To put it another way, bread is of little use to the man who has betrayed his soul, even if he is currently starving. Christ could clearly use his near-infinite power, as Satan indicates, to gain bread now to break his fast, even, in the broader sense, to gain wealth in the world, which would theoretically solve the problem of bread more permanently. But at what cost? And to what gain? Gluttony in the midst of moral desolation? That's the poorest and most miserable of feasts. Christ aims, therefore, at something higher, at the description of a mode of being that would finally and forever solve the problem of hunger. If we all chose, instead of expedience, to dine on the Word of God, that would require each and every person to live and produce and sacrifice and speak and share in a manner that would permanently render the privation of hunger a thing of the past. And that's how the problem of hunger in the privations of the desert is most truly and finally addressed. There are other indications of this in the Gospels in dramatic, enacted form. Christ is continually portrayed as the purveyor of endless sustenance. He miraculously multiplies bread and fish. He turns water into wine. What does this mean? It's a call to the pursuit of higher meaning as the mode of living that is simultaneously most practical and of highest quality. It's a call portrayed in dramatic/literary form. Live as the archetypal Savior lives, and you and those around you will hunger no more. The beneficence of the world manifests itself to those who live properly. That's better than bread. That's better than the money that will buy bread. Thus, Christ, the symbolically perfect individual, overcomes the first temptation. Two more follow. Throw yourself off that cliff, Satan says, offering the next temptation. If God exists, he will surely save you. If you are in fact his son, God will surely save you. Why would God not make himself manifest to rescue his only begotten child from hunger and isolation and the presence of great evil? But that establishes no pattern for life. It doesn't even work as literature. The Deus ex machina, the emergence of a divine force that magically rescues the hero from his predicament, is the cheapest trick in the hack writer's playbook. It makes a mockery of independence and courage and destiny and free will and responsibility. Furthermore, God is in no wise a safety net for the blind. He's not someone to be commanded to perform magic tricks or forced into self-revelation, not even by his own son. Do not put the Lord your God to the test. Matthew 4:7. This answer, though rather brief, dispenses with the second temptation. Christ does not casually order or even dare ask God to intervene on his behalf. He refuses to dispense with his responsibility for the events of his own life. He refuses to demand that God prove his presence. He refuses, as well, to solve the problems of mortal vulnerability in a merely personal manner, by compelling God to save him, because that would not solve the problem for everyone else and for all time. There is also the echo of the rejection of the comforts of insanity in this foregone temptation. Easy but psychotic self-identification as the merely magical Messiah might well have been a genuine temptation under the harsh conditions of Christ's sojourn in the desert. Instead, he rejects the idea that salvation, or even survival in the shorter term, depends on narcissistic displays of superiority and the commanding of God, even by his son. Finally comes the third temptation, the most compelling of all. Christ sees the kingdoms of the world laid before him for the taking. That's the siren call of earthly power, the opportunity to control and order everyone and everything. Christ is offered the pinnacle of the dominance hierarchy, the animalistic desire of every naked ape, the obedience of all, the most wondrous of estates, the power to build and to increase, the possibility of unlimited sensual gratification. That's expedience writ large. But that's not all. Such expansion of status also provides unlimited opportunity for the inner darkness to reveal itself. The lust for blood, rape, and destruction is very much part of power's attraction. It is not only that men desire power so that they will no longer suffer. It is not only that they desire power so that they can overcome subjugation to want, disease, and death. Power also means the capacity to take vengeance, ensure submission, and crush enemies. Grant Cain enough power, and he will not only kill Abel, he will torture him first, imaginatively and endlessly. Then, and only then, will he kill him. Then he will come after everyone else. There's something above even the pinnacle of the highest of dominance hierarchies, access to which should not be sacrificed for mere proximal success. It's a real place, too, although not to be conceptualized in the standard geographical sense of place we typically use to orient ourselves. I had a vision once of an immense landscape, spread for miles out to the horizon before me. I was high in the air, granted a bird's-eye view. Everywhere I could see great, stratified, multi-storied pyramids of glass, some small, some large, some overlapping, some separate, all akin to modern skyscrapers, all full of people striving to reach each pyramid's very pinnacle. But there was something above that pinnacle, a domain outside each pyramid in which all were nested. That was the privileged position of the eye that could, or perhaps chose, to soar freely above the fray, that chose not to dominate any specific group or cause, but instead to somehow simultaneously transcend all. That was attention itself, pure and untrammeled, detached, alert, watchful attention, waiting to act when the time was right and the place had been established. As the Tao Te Ching has it, he who contrives defeats his purpose, and he who is grasping loses. The sage does not contrive to win, and therefore is not defeated. He is not grasping, so does not lose. There is a powerful call to proper being in the story of the third temptation. To obtain the greatest possible prize, the establishment of the kingdom of God on earth, the resurrection of paradise, the individual must conduct his or her life in a manner that requires the rejection of immediate gratification, of natural and perverse desires alike, no matter how powerfully and convincingly and realistically those are offered, and dispense as well with the temptations of evil. Evil amplifies the catastrophe of life, increasing dramatically the motivation for expediency already there because of the essential tragedy of being. Sacrifice of the more prosaic sort can keep that tragedy at bay, more or less successfully, but it takes a special kind of sacrifice to defeat evil. It is the description of that special sacrifice that has preoccupied the Christian, and more than Christian, imagination for centuries. Why has it not had the desired effect? Why do we remain unconvinced that there is no better plan than lifting our eyes skyward, aiming at the good, and sacrificing everything to that ambition? Have we merely failed to understand? Or have we fallen, willfully or otherwise, off the path?